On a Sunday night, and we were doing open lines last hour on Coast to Coast AM. Before we get to our guest, Dr. James Hart, I wanted to grab Kathy. It seemed like every other caller, Kathy, was talking about the sightings down in Stephenville, Texas, and what that meant. And then I just happened to look up on my screen, and it said here that, am I catching this right? You're in Westfield, Massachusetts?
Yes, I am, Ian.
And that you may have seen something tonight, I understand.
I saw something, and I don't know what it was. And the reason why I'm calling is wondering if anybody else saw this. There was a very bright light in the sky, sort of pulsating, and it was about as high as the twin-engine plane that went by it, maybe about, I'd say, a mile apart. He circled around it and left, and he went towards Springfield, Massachusetts.
The plane did.
The plane did. So I know it was about the same height as the plane. This light was there before the plane came, and it was there for a good half hour, but it was like it was a pulsating light. It wasn't just a steady light. So I thought it was a helicopter. We do have helicopters around here because we have Westover Air Force Base and Barnes Air
Sure.
Force Base, and they do a lot of maneuvers. But the thing that attracted me so much is because it kept moving off, but very slow, and then it was fading in and out. And it was there for a good hour.
Well,
And
I tell you what, this is what we do then, and I appreciate you being patient and hanging on. We'll see whether or not anybody else resonates with that. Somebody else has a story like that. Somebody else thinks they may have seen that or heard about that from somebody, and ask them to email in, Kathy, and I'll try and get an update for you coming up next Saturday night. So thanks for letting us know about it, and let's see what we get from there. We got to get to our guest though, Dr. James Hart, The Art of Smart Thinking. He's a bio cybernaut, a spelunker of the brain, I think is how I referred to him last night. Somebody who's been spending a lot of time with helping people train their brains, brainwave biofeedback training. And we'll talk about this coming up and what a difference it might make for you once you understand it. Can it help you with spiritual awareness, with mental clarity, with creativity? I love this one on his list, forgiveness. Can we train our brains to be more forgiving? Or for that matter, can we train our brains to help us resist the temptation of dependency on things like alcohol and drugs or ADD or dissolving fears and terrors? How much control do you have over your brain that you're not using? We'll find out next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Dr. James Hart, I was just looking at your bio, and I could spend probably like the first half an hour talking about your education and the places where you worked. But can I just give some of the highlights here and say that undergrad at the Carnegie Institute of Technology, an MS and PhD in psychology from Carnegie Mellon. That pretty much says it. That's enough for me right there. Anybody who graduates with a PhD from Carnegie Mellon is obviously a guy who's got a pretty good melon to work with there to begin with. So thank you, Dr. Hart, and looking forward to this show quite a bit.
Me too.
I'm fascinated by the brain. And in fact, I was just looking at something the other day. I was watching one of those autopsy shows on something on HBO or something, and they were comparing brain sizes, and I was kind of struck by how just like there wasn't a lot of there weren't there wasn't a lot of vagaries in the brains themselves that they were putting out on the table. They were pretty much all looked the same, and I was kind of struck by that because I think, gosh, for something that looks the same, they sure operate so differently in everybody, don't they?
They do.
So what accounts for that? Why, if we have the same muscle tissue, if you will, between our ears, why are some people, super geniuses, and other people struggle to remember what they were, why they left the room?
Well, there's a couple part answer to that. Let's talk about the physical size. There's been a very careful study reported in Science magazine on brain sizes, and the Europeans of the 1500s had brains which were, on average, a cubic centimeter smaller in volume than modern Europeans. So over what's a very short time evolutionarily, the brain has swelled in size on average by a full cubic centimeter. Now,
That doesn't sound like much.
No, it doesn't. It's only 500 years if you look at the time frame. So the brains are getting bigger, but then the connections inside are what are most important. For example, Einstein's brain was saved, and it was found that he had a structure that was a tiny little structure that was associated with visualizing, and it was twice as big as the average person's. And so when Einstein did Gedanken experimenten, or thought experiments, where he actually saw himself riding on a beam of light and then just noted what the world looked like from that perspective, he could do that because he had a bigger visualizing center in his brain. It was tiny, but it was twice as large as average.
And yet, while you were talking about that, and you said the word Gedanken, my first thought was Gedonuts. So what's wrong with my brain? You say Gedanken, and the rest of your sentence just kind of goes woof right out the window, and all I could think of is Gedanken, Gedonuts.
Well, Gedanken, it's a German word, meaning Denken is a German verb meaning think.
Yeah.
And so Gedanken experimenten, which is how he described what he did, they were thought experiments.
Right, I got that. Okay. But I mean, but something, that's where I think in my own brain, I often find myself in that situation where I'm always making these connections that are absolutely meaningless. They don't bring me money. It doesn't help me be successful as a person. And I'm stuck with Gedanken Gedonuts there just while you were saying something really important. So if you had to like cut my brain in half, would you find that I have an extra smaller part of my visual brain or something that other people have?
Well, see, you've got the structure, but then you also have the electrical activity that plays in it. The structure is kind of like your hardware of your computer, but you could load as an operating system DOS or Windows or Linux or Unix, and your
right.
same hardware would perform differently. And so what we teach people how to do is to load a better operating system. Now, you talked about making associations.
Right.
Okay, so one of the things that happens in creative people is that they make good associations. And those good associations are made in a particular brainwave state. It's called alpha. And the difference between creative and non-creative people is that creative people have the ability, when faced with a problem, to turn on a higher alpha brainwave state or a higher pattern, more energy in the alpha band. And in that state, the brain goes around and, you know, takes something from column A and something from column B and something from column C, puts it together in a novel way, and voila, there you have the creative inspiration.
Well, I'd like to think that I have that. I don't know that I do. But tell me then more about how some people have that and some people don't. Mm-hmm. It's just purely the accident of their birth. Or could they be training their brains wrong from an early age and they have to go in and essentially get like a personal brain trainer to get that part of the brain reactivated again?
Well, if you buy a car or a cell phone or an iPod, you get an owner's manual with it and you learn how it works. But here we come into this world with this marvelous multi-billion cell brain. And there's no owner's manual, and the parents and the teachers and so on aren't really that knowledgeable themselves. And so people do the best they can, but it's not as good as can be done if you know a little science about how the brain works. And
okay.
So we help people by giving them, functionally, an owner's manual for their brain so they can operate the thing better.
And yet you can have the – I can have it. I was cleaning out my desk today, and I found an owner's manual for some – you know, cell phone I had two cell phones ago or something.
Uh-huh.
And I remember looking at it at the time, and it made absolutely no sense to me.
Yeah.
It even had pictures and flow charts, and I was like, just, and I tossed it away, and then I sat down, and in 20 minutes or so of just playing with it, I pretty much figured out how the phone worked. But I couldn't tell how it worked from the instruction manual, mm-hmm. which seemed to be holding me back mm-hmm. from being able to use it properly.
Understand.
So how does that happen with our brains? How can the same instruction manual do the same for each of the people who are receiving this information?
Well, feedback is effective to the extent that it's three things: accurate, immediate, and reasonably aesthetic. And so you know, what's reasonably aesthetic for one person may not be for another. But we've studied brain science, and we know, for example, that if you're going to give audio feedback for the presence of alpha waves, that you want to use tones that are between 400 and 800 hertz. We actually have that frequency patented because all humans have less disruptive effects of sounds if they are between 400 and 800 hertz. In other words, it disrupts their alpha less. So by studying brain physiology and psychophysiology, you can design an owner's manual or a training program that is optimized for how people learn.
Okay, so we'll, during the course of the show, talking about the book, The Art of Smart Thinking, Give Yourself a Brain Lift, what's a reasonable expectation for the listener tonight? What will they be able to know, or how will they be able to affect a change in their brain during the next 2 or 3 hours?
Well, for one thing, the book comes, if you get it through the website, theartofsmartthinkingbook.com, with a free e-course that teaches you in very practical steps how to apply the knowledge in the chapters to making specific beneficial improvements in your life.
Okay, good. But I mean, during the course of this show, what's the expectation? Because I don't want to overpromise, yet I find this material so interesting, I can't help but wonder, is it possible that during the course of the next couple of hours, we might be able to help somebody with a problem they're having with fears and terrors?
Absolutely. Or your forgiveness, okay. You mentioned.
Yeah, I found forgiveness a fast. How is forgiveness related to alpha brain waves?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And I'm going to answer it by referring to a Gallup poll, because George Gallup has surveyed Americans many times on the topic of forgiveness. And he found, for example, that 80% of Americans find that forgiveness is, or believe that forgiveness is very important. But of those, 85% have said that they cannot do it on their own. They need some help outside themselves, God's help or something. And of the things that George Gallup asked about, not even prayer correlated with effective forgiveness. Now, that's pretty strange. But of the things he asked about, there was one thing that correlated with effective forgiveness, and that was meditative prayer. Well, when you say meditative and then fill in the blank, what I see are alpha waves for meditative sewing, meditative fishing, meditative reading, meditative walking. And so there is a mind state that goes along with that, which is characterized by more alpha waves. So in a sense, George Gallup has confirmed our finding that forgiveness is only effective when it's done in a high alpha state.
Well, that's a very interesting idea, and I think the meditative prayer piece in particular is good. I would add this, as somebody who's spent a little time both in the subject of forgiveness and in prayer, that it's always important to remember that forgiveness is a process.
Yes.
And it takes a long time sometimes to come to that place. So it's as much a kind of an intellectual as it is perhaps an emotional process. You have to kind of get good with some realities of things that you may be very resistant to up front in order to eventually forgive somebody for something. All right, so I love that. But all right, so how would we be able to
I'll go through the steps, because there are four steps to prepare for forgiveness, and then there's the actual doing of it. Would you like to go there now?
Yeah, I'd be great. Yeah, okay. I think this is very interesting, and we can do this on other topics too, but why don't we use this one as an example to get started?
Sure, okay. So sometimes people know what they want to forgive, and sometimes they don't. Here at BioCybernaut, we have computerized mood scales, which allow us to read and discover emotions that are below the level of a person's conscious awareness. And when we present those, like let's say somebody comes up with afraid or sad or angry, and they denied it. They said, no, I don't feel that way. But if the computer, which is reading their brainwaves at the time they're doing this, if the computer determines that that emotion is within them, then in the interview I ask them about, okay, so, you know, what about this? And maybe right away, maybe later, maybe not till the next day or two, but then the incident that launched that negative emotion will come up, and the people associated with it. These are what we call forgiveness candidates. Now, many people know they're forgiveness candidates, or at least some of them, but they don't know how to forgive. So the setup for forgiveness involves four steps. The first one is you decide that you're going to forgive. you make a decision like, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I am going to forgive. Then the second step is in your mind, you go back to that time, that event where, you know, the thing occurred that upset you or wounded you or traumatized you, whatever it was, and briefly, you touch into it so you're now fresh with the emotion. Then you come back into the present and you find, this is a third step now, come back into the present, you find or make up some good that came from it. Like we had a guy from Switzerland one time, had a very tumultuous five-year relationship with his girlfriend, fighting, throwing dishes, that kind of thing. But somehow, and I never got the details, but somehow he attributed that difficult relationship to his being able to quit smoking. So that was the good that he found in that difficult situation. So then the fourth step, which is having found some good in it, and the good may be as simple as, wow, I learned never to do that again. I mean, that could be as far as you can go in finding good initially. And then the fourth step is you change your judgment about the person or about the thing. So decide to forgive, go back, re-experience the pain, then come back to the present, find some good, and the fourth step is change your judgment. And at that point, you're ready to begin the forgiveness process. Now, if you are at BioCybernaut, you're in the chamber, and whenever you make alpha waves, the feedback sounds are going to get louder. And so now what we recommend is that people have a courtroom, and they bring in the accused, and they put in some judges that could be, you know, high judges, Jesus, Mary, Buddha, you know, whoever these people, you know, but more than one. And
it's funny, you mentioned judges, and my first mental image was Babe Ruth.
Okay.
And I have no idea why he would be in my jury box, but apparently.
Well, sometimes people have like chosen their favorite playwright. The reason I suggest using someone higher than that is because you want these beings to be, you know, beyond, you know, human foibles. So that, because you're going to rely on them to tell you when you're done with forgiveness. That's the point of it. So you have the person, the accused, and you bring them in, you read the list of charges, and you really express your feelings. And then you go to the first charge, and you begin forgiving. And now, when you're in the training, you know when you're in alpha because the tones are getting louder. And when the scores come up every 2 minutes, if you've set a new high, the numbers will be green. If it was higher than last time, they'll be dark blue. And if they weren't better than last time, they'll be light blue numbers in the scores.
And somebody would see this if they're in the chamber. You would see all of this going. You wouldn't just be a mental thing. You would actually see colors and you would hear these sounds. And this is how you'd be starting to retrain your brain.
Exactly. So you know when you're in higher alpha. The feedback tells you when you're in higher alpha. And let's say that you try forgiving and all the scores come up light blue. Well, that means everything went down. So that's not for you at this time a good way to do forgiveness. So you try something else. And so you're guided by the feedback to do the forgiveness in a way that gives you higher alpha. Let me illustrate with a story that I talked about with Art Bell one time. We had a CEO of a $1 billion company in training. And on his mood scales the first day, angry came up. It was five sigmas on angry. I mean, if three sigmas would be a 99.7% chance that his denial was wrong. And the bigger the sigma you get, the more likely it is that his denial is wrong. And so we found that out. So I coached him. I said, you know, go into the chamber. And the next day he walked in and he had a list of all the people he was angry about because he'd seen how people working with their sigmas were able to turn up problems. And so he went into the chamber, he brought somebody to mind from his angry list, he got angry, his alpha dropped, the scores went down, and he was furious. And he was in a muddle. CEOs of billion-dollar companies want the numbers to go up, and his numbers were going down. And so eventually, sitting there in a stew, he thought something or he felt in a certain way about this person where he heard a little bit of tones, deedle, 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 and he was able to recover. Bring back into his, in front of his awareness, how he was feeling in those moments where he had a little bit of alpha while thinking about forgiveness. And then he held on to and continued that particular mental pattern, and all his scores turned green, which meant he set new highs. So the feedback helps you discover how to do the forgiveness in a higher alpha state. Now, if you don't have access
you got to hang on to that thought. We'll come back to that. Give yourself a brain lift. That's what we're going to shoot for tonight. The art of smart thinking. We'll talk a little bit more about creativity I got a great anger example from somebody in my own life, too, coming up next. What about you on this? We'll get to the phones, too, coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking with Dr. James Hart, the author of a really cool book and obviously doing some very helpful work for folks out there, The Art of Smart Thinking. Give yourself a brain lift, reverse brain aging, enhance creativity. We're going to talk more about that in just a second. And also increase your IQ. Ever thought this is something that you couldn't possibly do, that whatever the cards were that you originally dealt, you're stuck with? Well, maybe not. Maybe there's a way that that you can turn two of those cards back into the dealer and try to get a full house, if you understand what I mean, upstairs. Coming up next, we'll find out on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Coast to Coast AM on a Sunday night. This is Ian Punnett, and we're talking with Dr. James Hart. Do you prefer Jim, by the way?
I do. Thank you, Ian.
Okay. Yeah. And you know, you were talking about this this story about this CEO and how he was, through your institute, he was tapping into something about somebody with whom he was angry, and he found something about them, the way they were wearing their, you know, hair or something about them that didn't make him angry. And he was able to start focusing in on something positive about that person. And he was able to build on that and help that get over his anger. Well, am I putting too much in there?
Well, actually, he did something even more difficult, which was he focused on what made him angry and then attempted to forgive. And he tried lots of things, but the feedback told him by the alpha sounds getting louder when he was doing something that was effective forgiveness. And so once he learned what to do, it was, you know, pretty standard kind of a thing, a mental attitude to adopt, and he could apply that to every other instance in his life where he had gotten angry at someone.
Okay. I think that's very interesting. I remember talking with a friend who had a very difficult upbringing, and he tapped into his anger about his father's vacancy in his childhood, mm-hmm. and a sense of when his father was around was overly critical of everything he did, and he tapped into that as a teenager to get to be part of a very privileged high school academic program, and he would tap into that anger. You know, I'm going to get out of this house. I'm going to show that old man this, or I'm going to, you know, they'll never have this kind of control over me again, kind of a deal. I'll be a huge success. And he would tap into that as his inspiration for getting a college scholarship and for getting all of these accolades on a resume. And it worked for him for a long time, where that kind of anger provided energy. It gave him focus. And actually what seemed remarkable to me was that when he achieved a certain amount of success, he lost his focus because he wasn't so angry anymore. He had no other way to move his game up a level without just continually going back to that angry place. Does that sound familiar?
It does. And some people do the same thing with stress. I remember talking to one businessman about stress reduction, and he kind of exploded. He said, "Don't talk to me about stress reduction. I need that stress. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning. I go out and sell something." And I said, "Well, could you imagine boundless energy and enthusiasm without the stress?" And he looked at me with a blank stare, and he said, "Is such a thing possible?" And the same, I believe in focus.
Right.
We train focus. And anger is one of the things that focuses the mind, but it does so in a very destructive way. You know, there's a whole bunch of negative physiological things that occur when you get angry. Your adrenaline, your cortisol levels go up, your blood pressure goes up, a whole bunch of bad things. So the way to do, and building something with anger is like building a house with bricks that contain depleted uranium. It's going to be toxic, even though it might be strong. And so what we teach people how to do is to forgive so that they can have clear-minded, alert-centered, powerful focus that comes from joy and enthusiasm and all the positive emotions.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So these are some of the things you can do when you reconsider what your brain is capable of. I use the analogy of kind of like, draw poker. And that you may get dealt one hand, but it doesn't mean that's the one you have to live with.
Exactly.
How much brain changing can you do, though? I mean, what's the limit on that?
I haven't seen an upper limit. And I've seen people come in with very, very tiny alpha waves and go out having increased like by an order of magnitude or more. And this is really consequential. You mentioned reversing aging, for example. There was one study that was done with people being admitted to an urban hospital. Everyone who was admitted got an EEG, pregnancy, stabbing, elective surgery, auto accident, didn't matter. Anyone who was admitted got an EEG, and then they were followed up 6 months later. Half of the ones admitted with a non-alpha record were dead within 6 months. And so when people have atherosclerosis, once that sets in, their alpha slows by 8/10 of a hertz for every 10 years of life. And when it falls off the lower end of the alpha, which is 8 to 13 cycles per second, when it drops below 8, people enter senescence or senility, and the brain begins to dysregulate, you know, all kind of critical body systems, and they may not live long after that. So by restoring alpha with alpha feedback and other methods, you can, in fact, reverse aging in the brain. Now, you asked earlier, how could we do this for people on the show? Of course, if they come and they do the 7-day Alpha 1 training, then they'll learn with direct personal attention and in the feedback loop. But I wrote this book because I wanted to share some techniques for people that they could apply at home. There's an e-course that goes along with it. The Art of Smart Thinking book.com is a site where they can buy the book and get the free e-course. But in addition, we're also running now, for the first time ever, audience training. So people can come and pay the equivalent of $5 an hour to watch a group of people go through this one-week process. And we know about learning by imitation. Children learn that way very well, or vicarious learning. And so what I'm doing is trying to create ways to spread the alpha consciousness more broadly into our culture. Because in the alpha consciousness, people are happier, they're less stressed, they're more creative, their IQs go up, they can solve problems better, and they can forgive effectively.
You know, we were, as you were talking about forgiveness, and we were talking about anger earlier, and about learning from that, and I'm reflecting back on this video I think the whole country is seeing of a woman who was driving with her 2-year-old in the car. The kid was having some sort of tantrum. Mom was going through the car wash. She pulls the kid out of the car and sprays her daughter with water. And this is resulted, according to the news account I just read, the woman's going to be charged with this, some form of child abuse for this. The girl wasn't hurt, but she was sprayed with water in the in a high pressure hose in the at this car wash. And you could see that this mom had entered into some other state. I mean, like a lot of people do who are hormonal or who are, it seemed to, their brain seems to be flooded with something which impairs their judgment and takes them into some, you know, some area of their head that later on they don't even know how they got there. I mean, they reflect back on it themselves and they say, I don't know. And we hear this term all the time. I don't know what came over me.
Right.
What comes over them?
Well, we have in English the expression blind with rage and numb with fear. And so going back to that person that you mentioned who used anger to, you know, bring focus to their life, you can be sure that they were making along the way some bad decisions because they were making it in anger. And it turns out that there are brainwave patterns for each of the emotional states, and we've learned at BioCybernaut how to read those. And there are some real similarities between the brainwave pattern for anger and hostility and sadness and unhappiness and depression. And so if you allow yourself to get angry, you are practicing a brainwave pattern which is very similar to the pattern for unhappiness or sadness or depression. And so when a pattern comes in, it displaces other patterns. The pattern for clear thinking, for example, which is a gateway state into higher consciousness, has, you know, we're talking about, you know, if you have to imagine, we're going to make a map, a hyperdimensional map of brain activity where we've got frequencies and head sites, and so we create, in the sense, a mountain range. And the anger and the anxiety and the depression map has mountain ranges where the clear thinking map has valleys. And so One of the mountain ranges that goes up in anger is the beta. The beta activity goes up in anger, and the alpha drops out. And in fact, in depression, the alpha really drops out. And so that's what you would need, the alpha, for creativity, for being happy, for reversing aging. And anger erases it, actually replaces it with an inverse pattern.
Hmm. Well, I can imagine this. I would like to come and see it. I'd like to pay that $5 and just watch somebody else go through it before I went through it myself. But let me run another scenario past you based on something I'm looking at on your website, which, by the way, people can link up to Dr. James Hart's website at coasttocoastam.com. Just go from the link in the upper right-hand corner of your screen to the BioCybernaut website. But you have here attention deficit disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I took one of those online tests just out of curiosity because I was reading more and more about kids with ADD, and I thought, huh, I do that. And I was just sort of going through some things, and so I took this test, and according to the online test, I was a borderline ADD adult.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that was true for my childhood, although I remember always being told by teachers that I was very fidgety. But I wasn't a disruptive kid, and I was never I didn't have any problems in school per se. So I don't know that I'm some sort of classic case. But there was one thing I did, and I've done it my whole life, and I still do it, is if I'm trying to concentrate on something that I'm writing, I have to have something like the radio or television on in the background that kind of siphons off part of my attention.
Yeah, and nervous energy.
Is that what it is? And if I can have it on in the background and be like barely watching it, but it actually, where for other people it would be very distracting,
yeah.
And for me it's very focusing.
Mm-hmm.
What's that about?
Well, for example, in ADD, frequently the children or adults will have an excess of theta brainwaves so that they sort of zone out. And one of the things that excess physical activity does is it wakes up the brain and puts it into a more alpha state. Now, some people who train brainwaves will train beta brainwaves, which, yes, it does replace the theta, but beta, as we know, is a source of anxiety and various negative mind states. So what we train is alpha, which is one step up from the theta. And when kids or adults learn how to increase their alpha, and that replaces the theta that has them sort of drifty and distractible, then their scores go up in school, they don't have to take Ritalin anymore, and they become able to control their impulses.
Okay, well, tell me why, though, the TV on in the background while I'm writing helps me write.
Well, in your case, apparently, you have a nervous energy, which some part of your brain is going to go to that. Now, and so with that nervous energy drained off or something to focus on, then another part of your brain, say 80%, can focus on the task at hand. But what if that nervous energy weren't there, and so you could put 100% of your energy on what you were doing? Then you can go into a state that people call the zone. People go into a high alpha state, they become totally focused, and there aren't any distractions. And if there are, they don't even notice them. All they notice is like the ball that they've got to throw or, you know, whatever it is that they're working on. They go into the zone.
Okay. I wouldn't say, I mean, most people, if they were to describe me, I don't think anybody would say nervous. So what do you mean when you say nervous energy?
Well, what happens if you don't have that radio in the background? What do you feel?
Bored.
Okay. Well, let's talk about bored, because that's one of the hindrances to higher consciousness and spiritual growth that we get from the Zen tradition.
Okay.
This is described in the book. There were the five hindrances. To that, I've added a sixth one, forgetfulness. From Zen, the hindrances to spiritual growth and mental clarity are doubt, drowsiness, distractibility and worry, aversion and any form of ill will, and boredom. And then I've added forgetfulness. So if you have this, you sort of memorize the list, and any thought that comes into your mind, if it, one or more of the hindrances there, you know that that thought form is being generated by your ego. And so you can use that as an alert to reject that. Now, oftentimes, the ego will put boredom into your awareness if perhaps you're about to have an empty mind state in which you might, say, have an out-of-body experience or have some moment of very powerful insight. Have you ever had any experiences like
that?
Oh,
yeah. I used to have out-of-body experiences all the time. I've spoken of them a few times on Coast to Coast, but I mean, I had them, and what I found out later in life is my mother had them too, and that both of our experiences, which I as a kid referred to as ghosting, because that's what I felt like I was all of a sudden, that these little out-of-body experiences I would have would went away roughly right about the time that I was, like, probably in the midway through high school, so somewhere, you know, after the completion of puberty or something like that, they just went away, and I never had another one. I always wanted to have another one. I thought they were really cool. I loved them when they happened, and they happened spontaneously and apropos of nothing. There was no consistent impetus, it would seem like, that any sort of, you know, spark that started it.
Well, if I were measuring your brainwaves while you were sitting there, I would see a big burst of alpha activity in your brain just before you would have your out-of-body experience. And as long as that alpha burst would continue, you would be out-of-body. Now, your ego hates that. Your ego hates out-of-body experience because ego is the ultimate control freak. And when you're out-of-body, then it doesn't have anyone to control. And so this boredom that comes up is very effective, generated by the ego, to prevent you from having those spontaneous alpha bursts, which could allow you to go out of body again. So there's a method to its madness there.
Can
so
you create
those moments of boredom are actually willfully generated by the ego to distract you from having something wonderful happen in your brain.
Can you create out of body experiences for people?
Oh yeah. Well, no. Let me be precise. We can put them in an environment where they can increase their alpha so that they can give themselves an out-of-body experience. Sometimes people are afraid of that. Like when we're doing the interviews at the end of the day, in a brainwave feedback training, somebody will say, well, you know, I felt that I was a little lighter in the chair, and then it felt like my chair turned to one side. But when the scores came on, I could see I hadn't turned. I was still pointing straight forward. And I go, oh, those are premonitory signals of out-of-body experience, that feeling light in the chair. First of all, when it happens, don't focus on it. Do not focus on it, because focus will put you into beta, and it'll abort the experience. So just note it out of the corner of your mind's eye and go on with, you know, doing the feedback. Or if you're rotating to one side, some people go out-of-body like with a turn to the right or to the left. And so, yeah, if people have experiences like that, then I can coach them. And, in fact, some people say, no, no, I don't want to have that. And, of course, if the fear is there, then they're likely not to have it.
And at your institute, you work with people who have fear, too,
yes.
Obviously, people who are going through that process. And that's a very – I always find I have very little fear. I think I have the one fear that almost all – red-blooded Americans have, you know, fear of the mole people. But short of that, I really don't have any concerns about things. You know, I'd hate to have something happen to my children, but I don't spend my whole day thinking of ways to protect my kids. I have a certain amount of trust, and I don't live in a place of fear. But it's fascinating for me to watch people who do. And I when I see somebody going through a fear experience, like at a supermarket or something like that, I really almost like pull up a couple of bags of dog food, and I like to watch it in an odd sort of way, because it's so unlike who I think I am anyway. So I want to talk about that a little bit. Fear and the monkey wrench in the system that fear is. Are we talking about what you're going through? Do you want to expand your abilities? We'll talk more, and we'll get more calls coming up a little bit later on in the show from you. For Dr. James Hart. The book is The Art of Smart Thinking, Give Yourself a Brain Lift. I also want to get to creativity in a different sense, the formulas for creativity. Understand that better next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.